Hello, this is The Intersection. My name is Mark Bradley. It's the intersection of politics and culture. Thank you so much for listening to this latest podcast episode. Let me start by saying, mea culpa, mea culpa. Last podcast, I said I thought the Democratic presidential throwdown would be between Mike Bloomberg and Bernie Sanders. I was wrong. Turns out it's Joe Biden facing off against the senator from Vermont. At least half the media accounts of Biden's resurrection mention Lazarus. So I guess it fits, right? I mean, I can't look at an article about Biden and what happened from South Carolina through Super Tuesday without seeing some reference to Lazarus, which is interesting because it's a straight up biblical reference. Let's start with this. Biden had black voters of South Carolina to thank for his rise from the politically dead. Had he not taken South Carolina convincingly, Super Tuesday might not have turned out so great for the former vice president. And of course, Biden won South Carolina because of a huge plurality among black voters. As it happens, he took 9 states on Super Tuesday, including Elizabeth Warren's home state of Massachusetts. This made the sweepstakes for the Democratic nomination a 2-person contest, Biden versus Bernie. Biden is cast, of course, as the moderate, while Bernie is the standard bearer of the so-called left-wing, progressive, liberal, however you want to describe it. Keep in mind that there are still a bunch of states that are set to hold primaries, including delegate-rich states like New York, Florida, and Michigan. Quiet as is kept, this scrap for the requisite number of delegates may not be over just yet. The pundits, although they may tell you differently, know this already. They're busy savaging either Biden or Sanders, or in some cases, both of them. There's a risk that this could get ugly, as Elizabeth Warren said after she dropped out of the race. Some might say it already is ugly. The current situation exposes some interesting fissures among Democrats. Blacks, as mentioned, back Biden, especially older black people. Latinos, on the other hand, have backed Bernie through the early going. The generational divide has been in place for a while now, and we've talked about it in the past. Younger voters, including blacks, back Sanders. Older voters back Biden. That's why some in the media are saying that Biden does, in fact, have the advantage. Older voters, historically, tend to vote in higher numbers. Yet there's still the possibility that neither Biden nor Sanders will have the magic number of 1,991 delegates to secure the nomination outright. That will depend on who the delegates backing a candidate who has already dropped out decide to support. 4 of those candidates have now publicly backed Biden. That doesn't mean, however, that there are pledged delegates, and those delegates may not end up following their wishes. And then there are the superdelegates, numbering 700, who can tip the scales in either direction, although most punditry would estimate that those 700 superdelegates, if their votes were to count for much, would go with Joe Biden. I've said in previous podcasts that whoever wins the Democratic nomination will have to pull these differing strands of the party together in order to beat Donald Trump. You cannot subtract one of these components and expect to win. It may not be easy. As I said, there's been plenty of vitriol from supporters of both of these final candidates. Apologies to Tulsi Gabbard, who I think is still in the race. And lurking in the background is the current president, loaded for bear no matter who ends up winning. If it's Bernie, his theme will be, and I'm talking about Trump now, Trump's theme will be socialism and Bernie's embrace of socialism. That could potentially scare off some voters whose support of the Democrat could be crucial. Trump's attack line on Biden will almost certainly be the Ukraine and corruption and Biden's son Hunter. That, of course, is a virtual certainty. And there are published reports that say that Trump's people are already doing opposition research on Biden based on that fact. Now, that could be a problem for Biden because he hasn't really handled it well up until now. There may be some people in his camp that will sharpen his skills in rebutting this from Trump, assuming he wins the nomination. And certainly on Bernie's side, there are also people who are probably letting him know that socialism is going to be Trump's spear against his candidacy should he win the nomination. But you see, there's a lot more to all of this. Donald Trump is lurking in the background, but also lurking in the background are supporters of both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. And as mentioned, how much vitriol these folks are going to sling at each other and sling against the candidates they do not prefer. And the whole notion that Bernie bros, I don't know where they get that name from. I'm sure Bernie himself probably isn't all that comfortable with it, but that's what they call themselves. Supporters of Bernie Sanders have been out here slinging all kinds of mud at Joe Biden's supporters. And a lot of it has to do with Biden's past record on certain issues. And ironically enough, some of it has to do with Biden's record as Barack Obama's vice president. They will, and some people in Bernie's camp, and in other camps for that matter, will try and Velcro the parts of Barack Obama's legacy that they dislike the most, they will try and Velcro that to Joe Biden. And it might be difficult for Biden to get past his support of mass incarceration and deportations and drones and those sorts of things, which were the downside of the Obama legacy. Now, the smartest way that either one of these candidates can inoculate themselves against these attacks, whether they be from Democrats or Republicans, and the smartest thing they can do to balkanize the vote at this point would be to look at naming a person of color as their running mate. I don't know the extent to which they have considered this. My guess is they probably at this juncture have both started thinking about it. I know that going back a month or two, Stacey Abrams, who ran a very credible campaign for governor of Georgia, has come up as a possible running mate for Bernie Sanders, for example, or possibly for Joe Biden. Now there's word that Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, who dropped out of the race and promptly endorsed Joe Biden, that she might be the person that Biden would choose. Maybe not the smartest person to choose, but somebody who might be able to get him votes in some crucial states. I continue to maintain that whether it be Biden or whether it be Sanders, you're gonna need a person of color, and ideally at this point, a woman of color. You see, because there have been a number of problems with female candidates during these Democratic presidential sweepstakes. There were a number of women that were running, and one by one, they dropped out. And in some cases, sexism, which everybody in the Democratic Party thinks the party has gotten beyond, I wouldn't be so sure. I'm not sure that sexism did not play a role, at the very least, in the coverage of the female candidates, which is not up to the Democrats, that's up to the media. And I think that maybe the media has a wee bit to answer for in that regard. But the most interesting name I've heard as a possible vice presidential candidate for either one of the people who end up getting the nomination, whether it's Bernie, Biden, or whomever, and it's going to be Bernie or Biden, is Michelle Obama, the former First Lady. She would be a most interesting running mate because I believe she could pull together and bring out women and people of color, Black and Latino. See, because this schism between Blacks and Latinos, which generally speaking, at least on the East Coast, has not been made manifest in that many races, now we're seeing a schism, certainly a difference, between Blacks on the one hand supporting Biden and Latinos on the other hand supporting Sanders. So how do you bring them both together? I believe that if you're not going to nominate And she, I believe, is too young to serve as vice president. AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York, she can't actually serve. So I would be very interested to see whether or not Michelle Obama would even be interested in running as vice president, as a running mate of either one of these two. I'm not so sure she would necessarily run with Bernie, but she definitely might consider running with Joe Biden. Remember, Joe Biden was her husband's vice president, so it's entirely, entirely possible. And remember this, Donald Trump in 2016, despite all of the evidence to the contrary, won 41% of the female electorate and 52% of the votes of white women, which is, I found absolutely confounding, but numbers are numbers, facts are facts. Folks, the next few months are gonna be gut check time for those who want to electorally depose Donald Trump. And as my good friend Sly Francis points out, this is not just a race for the presidency. The composition of the Supreme Court, the Congress, which laws are passed, which laws are upheld, all of this hangs in the balance. Against this reality, the squabbles among the candidate's supporters turns out to be a wee bit trivial, at least I think so. There's work to be done, and the question becomes, are Democrats, are we up to doing the work? Let me know what you think. Leave a comment on my Facebook page or message me in my inbox at Mark Riley Media. Up next, the coronavirus outbreak. Who to believe, scientists or politicians? This is The Intersection.
Join the conversation at Mark Riley Media on Facebook.
Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of our podcast. We lost a jazz icon recently. McCoy Tyner has passed away at the age of 81. When my brother was schooling and lecturing me on the beauty of jazz, McCoy Tyner was one of the musicians he had me listen to. His brilliance shone brightly in the world of American music, and we mourn his passing. Now, onto the coronavirus, which has created fear and confusion around the world for a number of very good reasons. At last count, and this is about 24 hours ago, 106,000 confirmed cases have been documented worldwide, resulting in 3,600 deaths. Those numbers, again, will change most likely by the time you hear this. We've seen different governmental reactions to the spread of coronavirus. Italy has locked down the northern part of the country after confirmed cases doubled in a week. That would seem to be a political decision based on medical evidence, medical and scientific evidence, that is. One would think that's how most countries would react. In the U.S., the sense is most people aren't quite so sure. Americans have been given confusing information, and there's evidence that political concerns have contributed to that confusion. Right now, the number of cases in the U.S. stands at more than 420 and deaths at 19, 16 of which are in Washington State. New York State has declared a state of emergency, and a cruise ship that was off the coast of California and quarantined off the coast of California has been allowed to dock in Oakland after being rejected in San Francisco. At issue at least here in the States, is how well the scientific / medical community is working with the politicians who have to make decisions about public safety. The partial answer, at least on a federal level, is not so great. President Trump has consistently trumpeted the line that things are going well, and the administration, under the leadership of Vice President Pence, has things well in hand. All the while, according to some published reports, Donald Trump has worried about how the spread of the virus affects his re-election chances. A stock market that's lost almost 4,000 points might well be a political worry. However, most Americans, I think, are more worried about how contagious the coronavirus is and whether they're susceptible to it in their daily lives. Instead, they get to hear our commander-in-chief praise himself with the following words, and I'm not making this up, quote, "Every one of these doctors said, how do you know so much about this? Maybe I have a natural ability," unquote. Really? Seriously? This was at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, for God's sake. Such foolishness would be pathetic coming from anyone else. From the leader of the free world, it's something much worse. It means unless circumstances suit his political ends, nothing he says about the coronavirus can or should be taken all that seriously. And I understand that politicians are always, and I do emphasize always, concerned about how different events, particularly events that are out of their control, are going to affect their political fortunes. Donald Trump, however, takes this to an entirely new level, whether you want to call it an entirely new low, or simply an entirely different way of looking at something like an epidemic, a medical epidemic. How well are our politicians working with the people whose job it is to see whether or not they can find some sort of vaccine to cure the coronavirus and to keep the American public updated on the spread of this disease? There are people who are saying, people in fact in the Trump administration, who are saying that Americans may well soon have to live their lives a bit differently until this virus is contained and until a vaccine is found. Are we prepared to deal with that? Are Americans and people across the globe, in fact, prepared to deal with this? Now, I find some very interesting, I won't say dichotomy, but I do find some interesting things about the coronavirus and about where it's happening and why it's happening. And these are just questions. I don't have the answers. For example, why does it seem to be so heavily concentrated in the northern part of Italy? Is there something that went on there that people are not aware of? Why is it, for example, that Russia, which does have some cases, about 17 in all, huge population, 17 cases, and they share a 4,200-mile border with China, which is where we all think this thing began, the coronavirus. So why has Russia had so few and China had so many? Now, the Russians, by the way, and this may not be common knowledge in the States, but the Russians closed off that 4,200-mile border and said no Chinese could enter their country when it became apparent that there was a problem with the coronavirus in China. And, you know, you have some people, commentators, and I find this absolutely hilarious if it wasn't so tragic. You have some commentators, people with no medical or scientific knowledge whatsoever, and they sit up on television and talk about, well, you know, the Chinese are an authoritarian regime, and that's why it started in China. And of course, if somebody, if your loved one passes away from this, you should sue the Chinese government. Come on, are you kidding me? Is Russia less autocratic, less authoritarian than China? And yet Russia hardly has any cases. They have some, 17, but nothing compared to what's going on in China. So if it was a matter of authoritarian regimes being the source of the problem, that simply does not hold water. Last I checked, Italy is not an authoritarian regime. There are different countries, including both the United States and Great Britain, where the coronavirus is spreading. These are democracies, folks. The idea that this is somehow attributable to a form of government is a pundit's dream, and I assume for some people a politician's nightmare. But these people ought to know a great deal better than this. And right now, we don't know, other than the fact that the financial markets are gyrating like a go-go dancer in the 1960s, we don't know what exactly is going to happen with the coronavirus. We really do not. And Americans, in particular, deserve better than what they're getting from their president on this. Now, he's not the point man. To be fair, he appointed Vice President Mike Pence. But from what I've been reading and from what published reports are saying, he appointed Pence to the job because he wants the vice president to control the messaging about coronavirus. Not to say give the American people honest answers as the government gets them, but to control messaging, which is, by the way, for those of you who might be curious, not exactly the same thing. So I don't know how this is going to turn out. Maybe you have a different view of how this will turn out. Hit me up. Let me know. Join the conversation on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Our final segment deals with cultural memory and whether those of us who celebrate the recent past do so while ignoring the future that's before our very eyes. This is The Intersection. Questions I'm about to ask are not easy. They involve a bit of self-examination and maybe even some self-criticism. You know, as a young man, I enjoyed being part of New York City's underground nightlife. I'm not going to get into what that underground nightlife exactly was, but suffice to say, it was not something that was particularly public at the time. The places I went and the people I hung out with, however, helped shape the fabric of club life even today. One such place just celebrated its 50th anniversary. That's right, 50 years. The lost longevity was celebrated by, among others, the New York Times, the New York Post, National Public Radio, and both musical host David Mancuso at The Loft and DJ Larry Levan from the Paradise Garage have become close friends of mine over the years. They both sadly passed away. One thing the places I frequented and the DJs who played music in them had was a fearless ability to play new music. People like David, people like Frankie Knuckles, people like Larry Levan and others made breaking new musical ground an integral part of what they did. That was a big part of what made them unique, and that's why I used to go week after week to either the Loft or the Garage or both. We would come out of those spaces knowing we'd hear some wonderful songs that would soon become part of our record collection. As I say, those were the days. Fast forward 35, 40 years, a long time, and there's been a revival of interest in the very places I and many of my friends used to call home. Books, documentary films, scores of articles are testament to this retro fascination. It's not just in underground club music that folks are into looking back. Ska from Jamaica and other Caribbean music of the 60s are also in vogue. Yet one question nags me. Is my generation setting an example that says it's better to look back than forward? The few times I go out now in my old age, I find that there's an emphasis on the songs we used to dance to rather than anything new. When I ask some of my DJ friends, they say it's because the crowds they play for want to dance to the old stuff, not the new. When I hear this, I think to myself, are we all just looking in a mirror, hoping to see ourselves as we once were? I went to a party last fall and was startled to see someone dancing while moving around with the aid of a walker. And I'm looking and I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, we are all getting old. Now, there may not be all that much wrong with looking back, okay? For many of us, I think it's a matter of saying, these were the best times of my life. And I think that many of the people that go to some of the reunion parties, whether it be the Paradise Garage or the Loft 4 times a year, they're looking to recapture something. They're looking to relive something. And there may be nothing inherently wrong with that. But what surprises me is that as we were young people, we reveled, and I mean absolutely reveled, in the notion that we were breaking new ground, that the music we were listening to, which was not music that you could hear on the radio by and large, certainly not at the very beginning, that music was something special to us and to people who were going to these different dance clubs throughout the city of New York and in fact throughout the nation and the world. And when I say the world, I'm not exaggerating, because a lot of the music we danced to did not even come from the United States. The fact of the matter is, it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. But it was also cutting edge. And maybe there's a scene someplace that I'm not aware of where maybe younger people are dancing to the kind of cutting edge music that we found so compelling so many years ago. I hope so. I really, really do hope so. You know, it's easy, I guess, when you get to be a certain age to look back, because it's hard to imagine that the best is yet to come. But why not? Maybe that experimental spark that informed our young lives could still be there. Maybe all we have to do is look for it and be open to it when we find it. It's a matter to me of saying, what are we open to as we get old? I mean, I could be just misstating or overlooking this entire thing. Maybe when I was young, there were people who were older who looked back on their best times and said, you know, wow, the Charleston or the dance halls in the 1930s or whatever was the best time of their life. And maybe that's what they were longing for. And to be honest, I've seen, you know, there are barbershop quartets. There are a lot of different organizations, groups, scenes, as it were, where the past is celebrated. I understand it. But I hope and I wish that there was some way to recreate the spark of discovery that we had. Okay? And maybe not for us. Maybe my generation really is not at this point in our lives prepared to deal with seeking out new music. I think in a lot of cases, we listen to stuff that came out 80s, late 70s, maybe stuff that many of us didn't hear back then. But we listen to it now and think, wow, that was some great stuff. But where's the new stuff? There's great new music coming out. I am not, and I want to be very clear about this, I'm not one of these people who sits up and says, well, all the great music came in the 70s, or all the great music was in the 80s, or all the great music was in the 90s. There's great music being made. It may not be music that everybody dances to anymore. Maybe that's too much to expect. But the flip side of that is, people like my daughter, people her age, are dancing to different types of music. And I can hear, in some cases, shades of the stuff I used to dance to and the stuff she loves to dance to. I can hear some of the same rhythms, I can hear some of the same block chords, etc. But I also realize that it's not really for me to jump up and say, well, that's not new. You know, I heard so-and-so do it. Maybe that's not my place. Maybe my place is to say, I'm glad you like it. Maybe it's my place to say, be open, younger people, to new music that's in your midst. And as much as we can do as older people to help you find it, maybe that's what we're here for. Maybe that's living our best life as older people. Thank you so much for listening to this edition of The Intersection. The executive producer of the program is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. Until we meet again, please be well.